Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show, where business owners, professionals, and entrepreneurs gather to discover playmaking ideas for success. Your host is internationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author, Steve Klein, who sits down with fascinating playmakers who have made themselves and their company successful. Steve will introduce you to CEOs and executives who discuss their playmaking path toward success. And now, it's time to meet this show's playmaker. Here's your host, Steve Klein.
An unknown author said, "Smart executives know that they do the things they need to do when they need to do them, so someday they can do the things they want to do when they want to do them." Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show. I'm Steve Klein. In the studio today is a guest who has done the things he and his company needed to do. Today's Playmakers company dropped 80% in revenue and survived. With us today is a CEO whose company began in 1901 with two partners and three lumber yards in Dalhart, Texas. This great playmaker is Jack Foxworth. Jack is president and CEO of Foxworth Galbraith Lumber. Now, Foxworth Galbraith is a successful family-owned and operated company that conducts business based on a commitment to honesty, service, quality, and strong family values. Foxworth Galbraith Lumber Company, a distributor retailer into residential and commercial construction, as I mentioned, was founded in 1901. Foxworth Galbraith now operates 32 branches in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, and Oklahoma. After growing up in Dallas, Jack received his BS in industrial engineering from Stanford University. He began his career with Intel and returned to Dallas to join the family business in 1982. Over the last 35 years, Jack has been an invaluable contributor to the success of the business. He's held various positions such as VP Information Technology, CFO, and COO. Well, Jack, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
You have an interesting background. The company has an interesting background. But the first question I want to ask you is, why industrial engineering?
You know, that takes me back to my high school years. I loved math and physics. My father was a physicist and a mathematician. He turned into a businessman later, and I had anticipated going into physics when I went to Stanford. But out there, I decided, you know, the physics, as much as I enjoyed it, it may not be the practical degree I needed to build a life. So industrial engineering at the time at Stanford was what I would call a very technical business degree, a lot about operations research and material planning and so forth. And so I decided that would be the practical path to take.
Even though your family was in the lumber business, you preferred to go that direction?
I did in my family, and I credit my father and mother, but they never steered me academically or professionally in any direction. I had some exposure to the family business, but it was something I knew I had no interest in at the time. And so I wanted to go, again, explore math and physics and the sciences. And it wasn't until after a couple of years at Intel, I decided I wanted to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond, and that's what brought me back to the family business.
Well, the second part of that was why Stanford? Now, I know Stanford has strong alumni, and one of the things I got in your bio was you want to get involved with all things Stanford. What was the appeal initially going to Stanford and not going to a school in Texas?
You know, I was went to a local private school, St. Mark's, and had a wonderful experience at St. Mark's. But I really wanted to spread out. I wanted to go as far east or as far west as I could. As a mathematician and scientist, I was looking at MIT and Caltech and Stanford. And in many ways, I was a little bit of a, at least I thought I was, a little bit of a hippie. So it was my trip to Stanford in Northern California. In a short period of time, I found out how open-minded they were, how curious Stanford students and faculty were about so many things. And that's really what sent me out there, is just being curious and wanting to be with curious people. And that continued to play out in my association with Stanford. My late wife, who was from Dallas, started at UC Santa Barbara, transferred to Stanford, where she graduated. And then all three of our children went to Stanford and graduated from 2010 through 2013. So have a great association with Stanford.
Going back to what you were studying, which was industrial engineering, as CEO, does any of that ever come to play in terms of running Foxworth Galbraith Lumber?
In a word, no. you know, my background as a scientist and mathematician and engineer was about process. It was about executing, being efficient. The role that people played in business was, at least in my young professional career, was insignificant. It was about getting the systems and processes correct. And through my experience at Foxworth Galbraith and through, as I'm sure we'll touch base on, the contraction of our company, I've come to learn that the success we have and most people have in business is all built on people. And so all those things I learned about, you know, whether it was electromechanics or mechanical engineering and industrial engineering, really aren't relevant today. It's more about the behaviors of people, understanding them, understanding my own behaviors that I use today in my role at Foxworth Galbraith.
Hearing now about your interest in getting into that, I can see why you mentioned before the show started that historical facts are not something you keep in your brain. But I do want to hit one piece before we go to the contraction of the company about the beginning of the company, because there is a lot of history with this company beginning in 1901. So just a quick overview. Tell us how your great-grandfather became a part of a company that became Foxworth Galbraith.
Well, my great-grandfather and my family came out of Mississippi. I don't know a lot about the 1800s, but we moved from Mississippi into Texas. And my great-grandfather, whose name was Walter Foxworth, in the panhandle of Texas, met two other gentlemen, a gentleman named Jackson and Galbraith, who had a small lumber yard or chain of lumber yards at that time. And I don't know why, but they hit it off. They knew they shared a lot of common values, which we still share within the company today. At that time, when the Jackson and Galbraith and Foxworth merged, Jackson sort of left the picture shortly thereafter, and it became just the Foxworth and Galbraith families. And at that time, we started to grow with the rail lines from east to west and acquired a chain of operations. I believe it was called the Gray Lines in the early to 1900s. Since then, both families, Foxworth and Galbraith, have shared the ownership and leadership of the company now for 118 years. I represent four generations. There is a Galbraith, a young man, Ian Galbraith, who is four generations with Foxworth Galbraith as well. So the two families in parallel have shared a lot and the values of the company for over a century now.
It was an interesting place for a lumber yard or a company to begin in Dalhart, Texas, far, far northwest Texas in the panhandle. But that, as you mentioned, were the rail lines, and that was a big part of that, too. In 1937, the company moved to Dallas. Was that because the company was growing a lot farther and needed to be in a more metro area?
I'm not sure it was the opportunities for growth in Dallas, but I think it may have been more of a central business position across what we had hoped to be our footprint would be in the Southwest. So as we grew into New Mexico with those acquisitions, Dallas just seemed like a logical business hub that we would want to be in. And then subsequently, Dallas and its growth have been wonderful for us and part of our key part of our business for many years.
Well, you said at the beginning that you went to work for Intel out of Stanford. You were there for a few years, but came into the family business back in 1982. What caused that transition to occur?
I'd like to think I'm not quite as impatient as I was at that time, but as a young 22, 3, 4-year-old man, and I thought I was hot stuff, and I went to Intel, and I loved what I did. I had a lot of exposures to some wonderful leaders at Intel. But the bottom line was I became impatient, and I wanted to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. And although selling lumber and distributing building materials in the Southwest into new home construction and some retailing, that's not closely aligned with semiconductor and chip manufacturing. But I thought, you know, that's where I want to go. I can make an impact there. And so I got impatient and decided to come back and see if I could make something happen here.
Well, if nothing else, you've had an impact in this company. But what year did you become CEO?
You know, it's we're in 2019. It was probably around 2011 or 2012. My partner and good friend, Jimmy Galbraith, had been the president and CEO for a number of years before me. And as we were coming out of the contraction and we returned to profitability in 2012, I think that was the time that he and I looked at that thought it would be a good time for me to move in that role. And Jimmy retired, give or take a year, probably about 6 or 7 years ago.
Then my guess is even though you weren't CEO, you were very involved with the contraction and with the Great Recession back in 2008, 2009. But let's talk about that now, because the business was doing very well. You were just under $1 billion in business, $830 million. And you had a, I guess the word I need to use is a huge drop, like a stone. Tell us exactly how far you dropped down and what happened at that point, and then how you were able to help turn the company around.
You know, and I've got to give a tremendous amount of credit to Jimmy Galbraith, who was at the helm through the most difficult time in my tenure here. When a company over 5 years loses 80% of its revenue, 80% of our branches, 80% of our employees, that's a tough environment.
That's losing a whole company almost.
It is. And we had grown quite a bit through acquisition and some organic growth, as you said, to $830 million. And we had aspirations to exceed $1 billion. But for us, you know, the big catalyst was the contraction in home starts. And that's really what drives much of our business. And so when that demand dried up, we had built an organization that was moving towards $1 billion in revenue. We had 74 branches across the Southwest and a large corporate staff here in Dallas. And when that demand dries up, we had too much capacity, too much cost, and we just had to get a better alignment. We just didn't know how deep and how fast, as most of the people in our industry didn't know. We didn't know where the bottom was, and we chased that down. We closed, you know, from the maximum 74 locations down to about 24, 2,800 employees down to 500 employees at our low, and that $830 million went down to about $145 million in revenue. A lot of loss, negative cash flow, a lot of loss to that period of time, but it was our desire to continue after over 100 years. We weren't going to lose it on the Great Recession, and we had great people, as I said, Jimmy Galbraith at the helm and many other wonderful people that helped steer through that time frame. And, yes, I did share in it also. We all made a lot of sacrifices, and we did things we didn't know we could do until we had to do them and succeeded.
As we all know, everything is cyclical. And you probably knew during that time that things were going to turn around. But like you said, you didn't know how far bottom was going to be when you did that. My question is, we've talked about the fact that this is a very conservative company. Being conservative, and still is, but being conservative, did that help get through the Great Recession?
Absolutely. And conservative, you can look at through several different lenses. I think the most important lens is through our financial management and how we managed our balance sheet. When we grew to $830 million, we did have some debt, but it was relatively low. After 100-plus years of being in business, we owned most all of our real estate. And so we had very little serviceable debt and a very strong balance sheet, and that enabled us to support some negative cash flow through that decline. I think one of the other things that happened with our balance sheet, we were not great working capital managers. We have a tremendous amount of money we loan to our customers. We have large inventories, and this working capital we kind of took for granted when profitability was easy. When the collapse came, we learned how to be better working capital management. We were able to squeeze out a lot of cash out of that inventory and receivables. And today we maintain a very healthy working capital level in a working capital environment. But it was our balance sheet, the relatively small amount of debt we had, and a lot of trapped value in our real estate and our ability to tighten up our working capital management that helped us through that tough time.
Well, 2012, you began to come out of it. You moved up to $500 million, half a billion dollars, which, looking back, this all started about 2007, 2008. So 4.5 or so years, you were able to turn the company around. In hindsight, that's not a long time. But as you were going through that, that was probably as hurtful as could be. But the question is, how and why were you able to come through it so quickly in a 4.5 year period and really triple what you where you were at when you hit bottom?
Well, the decline, of course, it may that period from 2008 to 2012 when we returned to profitability, that's a fairly short period. But of course, as you described at the beginning, the stone dropped. There were deep declines in revenue and capacity every year chasing down. And as I said, a lot of losses. We lost about half the book value of the company in that window of time. But our ability to recover since then largely is built off of the residential starts that were recovering. So the country was built over 2 million residential or had over 2 million residential starts at the peak. Then when it fell off, it fell down to 400,000 or 500,000. There was so much pent-up demand when you came out of 2012 and started building the country again, and the residences were being built again. That was our opportunity to grow. When we returned to profitability, we continued to be conservative, so we generated a bunch of cash, and it enabled us to make some acquisitions. So after the start started to return, we did acquire a company in Oklahoma, which was our entry into Oklahoma, hugely successful. That was about almost 3 years ago. And last year, two very positive acquisitions for us, one in New Mexico, a small town of Roswell, and then we have another organization we acquired in Central Texas, which would have been an absolutely wonderful addition. So we get a significant amount of our growth out of organic, but much of it has come through acquisition, positive, profitable acquisition. And so that's enabled us to return to about $500 million in revenue, all very profitable right now.
Well, you probably received your master's in business in that 4.5 years. You probably had an excellent education in that 4.5 years. What are some key lessons that you and the company learned as you were pulling yourself back up by your bootstraps?
First off, on a personal note, one of the things that I learned, all of us, the great people that survived with me at Foxworth Galbraith, were able to do things that we never thought possible. When your back is up against the wall and you're pulling together and focused on the same thing, and that's survival, just so much we accomplished together coming out of that. And I learned a lot. That was part of me learning about the importance of the people we have, how they contribute. And I learned a lot about myself, becoming much more self-aware in my behaviors and what's causing me to do the things I do. Huge, huge learning, and I apply that every day today. But from the company's perspective, I remember when we finally thought we were out of the contraction, we returned to profitability, we had the senior leadership team spent a day debriefing about the previous 4 or 5 years and what did we really learn out of it. And there are about 6 or 7 key points that I would share with the group, one of which is about cash and the value of tight working capital management. If we hadn't been able to squeeze cash out of our balance sheet, we wouldn't be here today. And we continue that conservative fiscal management with our balance sheet. Secondly, and along with that, is minimizing the serviceable debt that we have. Another thing that was very important for us was to communicate internally, proactively, not only within the organization, but then take that communication out to our shareholders, to our vendors, and to our customers. So many people, myself included, are afraid to admit that they've got challenges, and we want to keep the brand nice and polished. That doesn't do anybody any good, and we got out in front, especially with our vendors and customers, who were all in the same boat we were, to share those challenges. That was really critical to the company's success. Making decisions quickly, and making the tough decisions. You know, it's so easy to be optimistic when you're chasing a decline that, well, our revenue dropped 10% last year. It can't go down another 10%. Or the housing starts have dropped from over 2 million to 1 million, and it can't go any longer or go any lower. And so we tend to be overly optimistic. And we learned that we can't. You know, we've got to look at some of the toughest, some of the worst case scenarios to be sure we can survive those. And that's something that we would do again the next time the a contraction comes, the down cycle comes. And then finally, our people. We lost a lot of wonderful people. In fact, it's exciting. Of the people we lost through the decline, we have many of them that have come back to us since we've been growing again. But all the people that survived with us, we learned that they were able to do things that they didn't think they could do. And we share the journey together. We all pull together. The associates, our employees, were able to make sacrifices that none of us thought they could. And we also learned that it's those people that carried us through such a decline that we want to invest in, and we want to have them continue to be part of the success of Foxworth Galbraith. And we do that today. We have a lot of great training programs and continue to have people that continue on that journey with us.
Well, the bottom line from everything you just said, it's all about the people.
It is.
Wasn't necessarily dollars, though dollars are important. It's all about the people. But another word that came to mind as you were going over what you learned was the word creativity. I'm sure all of your minds became overactive in terms of what new ways, what new things can we do to turn this company around. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I'm a little embarrassed to share this, but at one point in time, because we initially didn't focus on our cost structure, we had built an organization and we had great people in it, and we had a machine that was going to lead us to $1 billion. So when the revenue started to decline, we didn't look at cutting costs. We looked at how we're going to replace that revenue. We did get creative, even to the point of thinking, well, can we put donut shops and other things in our physical plants to bring people in? And obviously we didn't, and we probably wouldn't have made donuts very well. But we did get creative. We got creative on how we can consolidate positions. We can eliminate the unnecessary expenses. And we did adjust our cost structure, and we also found new revenue opportunities as well.
So what is the future for Foxworth Galbraith right now? Where are you going building from $500 million? Where do you see yourself in 2, 5, 10 years?
We're going to maintain profitability through that 2, 5, 10 years, and we will have another contraction, hopefully a small contraction, and we're prepared to deal with that. I think you know, we're in the 5 states you named at the beginning. I can see us perhaps growing geographically into some periphery states. We love the Southwest. We think it's a great place in the country to do business, and there's great growth here. I can see us probably with a little bit more manufacturing in our product mix. We produce roof trusses and floor trusses and wall panels, and to a lesser degree doors, but I can see that segment of our business growing quite a bit. As the building technology and building techniques change over time, we'll adapt, and I suspect we're going to have more component construction, and we'll be in doing more of that going forward. I think we're going to keep having the same values that have driven the company for over a century. We're going to find those values in our people and in the mergers and the acquisitions we make. We typically look for growth with cultures that will align well with ours, and I think you'll find more acquisitions. And so we'll be larger, maybe $1 billion or so in the next 4 to 5 years, much of it through acquisition. Continue to maintain fiscal conservatism that has saved us for many, many years. I'm hopeful that we're going to be proud of the organization that we, myself and the leadership and many other people, will be building over the years to come.
Well, you have a success story that you've been telling, but I think the value of the success story is being able to come back from everything you went through and the pride you have in that, and continue to build from that. So you've obviously done a good job. For those companies or individuals who would want to find out more about Foxworth Galbraith Lumber, where do they go?
Well, the first place to start is our website, and you can find that at www.foxgal.com. But I think the website is a great place to start. It has our map of all the locations we are in throughout the Southwest, and we have our phone numbers and contact information there. So that'll be the best place to start.
Well, Jack, this has been a terrific show, just finding out more about what this company has done, where you've been, how you pulled around, especially being in business over 100 years now. This has been fantastic. Thank you very much for being a guest on Playmakers Talk Show.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
Well, you're definitely a playmaker, and the company's a playmaker, because a playmaker is somebody that makes something happen. And you obviously, you and your people have made things happen at Foxworth Galbraith, so congratulations.
Thank you so much. We're excited to have done well in the recovery.
And for our listeners, thank you very much for joining us at PlaymakersTalkShow.com. Please join us again for additional guests. And again, it's PlaymakersTalkShow.com, and we're going to be back with more Playmakers. See you then.
You've been listening to Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein. Join Steve again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com for more interviews with interesting and successful playmaking CEOs and executives.